Welcome to Community and Ecology, a KZYX special series of programs that takes an in-depth look at environmental and social issues confronting us in Northern California and Mendocino County. This series originates with the Mendocino Institute, a not-for-profit educational and research center located on the Mendocino coast. I'm Cal Winslow, director of the Mendocino Institute. Our guest today is Dr. Karina Nielsen. Dr. Nielsen is an associate professor of biology at Sonoma State University. She has a PhD from Oregon State University. Today, we will continue our discussion of ocean protection. But first, a little about Dr. Nielsen. Her interests are marine community ecology, oceanographic influences on benthic communities, plant-herbivore interactions, physiological ecology of macrophytes, ecosystem functioning and conservation ecology. That's all a mouthful.
Certainly a mouthful.
Did I do okay?
You did great.
All right. Her research focuses on ecological functioning and conservation biology of temperate marine communities. She uses ecological, physiological, and oceanographic tools to investigate how environmental context influences biological interactions. She has done field experiments in Oregon and Chile and New Zealand, as well as here on the Mendocino coast. She teaches invertebrate biology, marine ecology, ocean science literacy for school and society, diversity, structure, and function. She lives in Redwood Valley part of the week, in Santa Rosa the rest. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Can I call you Karina for
please.
The... Yeah? All right. We won't be too formal. Karina, let's jump right into a problem we've discussed, and we talked a bit about with Bill Lemos last week. What has just happened on the Sonoma coast? What has happened to the abalone population there?
Well, yeah, some of you are probably aware the recreational abalone fishery in Sonoma County, and Sonoma County only, was closed early this year, about 2 months early. And the reasons for that are kind of a bit of a surprise. It's not only abalone, though, that's been affected, and I think that's something important to notice. We have a regulation where the abalone fishery was closed, but we had a lot of abalone die and wash up on the shore. We also had a lot of urchins die. We also had a lot of sea stars die. We had a lot of chitons, gumboot chitons. They're kind of mollusk. And some of the mussels that you see on the coast, on the shoreline, also died. So it wasn't just the abalone. The abalone was what was in the headline. So what caused this, right? Why are all these strange groups of animals just all of a sudden dying and washing up so suddenly? Well, that was a big mystery to us, and one of the things that I spent a lot of time doing is working with students who go out to the shore and do basic biological studies. And as it turns out, what looks like was the causative agent, was certainly associated with all of those die-offs, was a microscopic organism, something tiny that lives in the water, that photosynthesizes. And the organism is called a dinoflagellate. And dinoflagellate is just a name for this group of organisms that tend to swim around in this tiny whirling motion. And they form part of the base of the food chain in the ocean. So they're members of the group of organisms we call phytoplankton. So phytoplankton, tiny microscopic cells that lots of other organisms eat. Including tiny crustaceans that then fish will eat, mussels will eat them, all kinds of organisms eat them. So why all of a sudden am I saying that this thing that's the base of the food chain, that sustains sort of life in the ocean, if you will, this organism that has the potential to be sustenance, has potentially caused the die-off of all these organisms? Well, as it turns out, some of these dinoflagellates produce toxins. And one of the reasons they produce toxins is to protect themselves from all of these organisms that are trying to eat them. That's one potential reason. And as it turns out, when my students have been out trying to understand the base of the food chain, they collect water samples, and they collect them daily to look at the phytoplankton and look at which species are there. dinoflagellates aren't the only things that we see in the water. We also see diatoms. We see other kinds of flagellates, a whole variety of tiny microscopic plants, if you will. Okay, so what's the connection between these two things? Well, it turns out that at right exactly the time that we started seeing all these animals dying, we saw a sudden increase and complete dominance, if you will, in the water of this one particular species of dinoflagellate. Often there's a diversity of species, but when you get a bloom, which is simply just a really big increase in the population of a particular species of phytoplankton, you'll see it dominated by one species. And in this case, it was a species called Goniolax spinifera. And I guess I should pause here and say, it actually probably isn't one species. We know so little about these dinoflagellates and these phytoplankton that what we suspect now is that Goniolax spinifera is actually a complex of species that look really similar, that are hard to tell apart. And this species became incredibly abundant immediately at the same time that all these animals started dying off and washing up on our shores. And the minute they basically stopped dying, that species declined dramatically in abundance in the water column as well. So, cause and effect, the dots maybe aren't totally connected yet. Lots of evidence pointing to that species, and I haven't gone into all those dots yet, but we can talk about those. But seemingly a really tight connection between the occurrence of these two events. So, let me take a sip of water here for just a sec. What happens? In this particular situation, of course, all of the local scientists who study marine organisms are wondering what the heck is going on. I've never seen a die-off like this before. Never seen this particular group of organisms affected. Some of them are closely related, some of them are not closely related. We had several species of sea stars die, and not others. We had several species of abalone die, we had several species of chitons die, but not other chitons. In the marine lab, out on the Sonoma coast, the Bodega Marine Lab, part of UC Davis, a lot of my colleagues work out there. They often keep animals in the laboratory to study, and they take seawater in to their tanks. And that seawater brings in the phytoplankton, and those animals will feed and be exposed to the water and the phytoplankton. And then that water will be discharged back into the ocean. So it's just sort of this continuous flow-through system. The animals in the marine lab, they died at the same time, the same group of animals that we were seeing out on the shore. This was obviously very alarming to the folks who work on them. But we have people out there, for example, who work on pathology of abalone, who work on toxicology of marine organisms. We have marine ecologists out there who work on the kinds of things I work on. And they all had different pieces of evidence about what was going on. And this is how we're starting to piece together the story or answer the mystery of what could possibly be the relationship between these two events, this phytoplankton bloom, this mystery species that showed up, and the death of these animals. So the way scientists work and try and look at these things is they don't just say, well, these two things happened together, must be the cause. They actually try to investigate, well, what are other possible explanations? Is this the only possible explanations? They're skeptical. So a lot of us sat down and put our heads together and started going, well, what could be the cause? We often see die-offs of the animals when there's low oxygen in the water. And when you have a big bloom of phytoplankton, sometimes it's enough that as those phytoplankton start to die, microbes will come and start degrading them, and they'll consume oxygen in the process. So sometimes you can get low oxygen as a consequence of a bloom. Well, it turns out the scientist said, let's go see if there's what the oxygen levels are like in the tanks. It's not something they measure regularly, but they went and they put an oxygen probe in the tanks where the animals were dying. Plenty of oxygen. Okay, so we think we've ruled out that hypothesis, if you will, or that idea about why they might be dying. Another idea, well, maybe there was some bacteria, some disease, some pathogen that caused them to die. Maybe it just happened to be coming up at the same time as this unusual phytoplankton. Well, As I said, there are pathologists out there who work on invertebrates and some of the species that were dying, and so far they haven't really come up with anything that looks like a pathogen. They then also, the timing, the rate at which they died was so quick that it seems inconsistent with the development of a viral outbreak or bacterial outbreak. Another idea was, well, okay, we know that sometimes these organisms produce toxins. Mussels, which feed by gathering phytoplankton out of the water and consuming them, tend to accumulate those toxins in their tissues when they're present. All right, let's take some of those mussels that were dying and died during this event, send them off and have them tested for some of the common toxins that we will see from big phytoplankton blooms. And there are a few other species of phytoplankton that produce toxins, things like domoic acid that come from diatoms, things like they can cause what we call paralytic shellfish poisoning, amnesiac shellfish poisoning, things that affect humans. And so we test for those things fairly regularly. They did a screening of all the sort of commonly known toxins. None of them were present. Okay. Well, as it turns out, this species or species complex, Goniolax spinifera, is known in some cases to produce a toxin called yesotoxin. Yesotoxin is a relatively newly described toxin. It's not very well understood. It's only been detected once before in California, but it hasn't really been looked for too much. So it turns out that, in fact, yesotoxin was detected in the mussels at a very relatively low level, but definitely present at the same time that this bloom was occurring. Okay, so we think we have now a toxin. We're not really sure what the toxin does. We know it's produced by the species that was abundant. It's never before been reported to kill, though, this group of animals. So you can see this is still a little bit of a mystery. We've got a lot of pieces of the puzzle, but the dots aren't totally connecting yet. My student, who was collecting these phytoplankton samples, she was one of the first people to identify this species as being present in the water at the time. Her name is Adele Paquin, and she's a graduate student of mine. She's really interested in phytoplankton and sort of why they bloom when they bloom, which species are in the water, when, those kinds of things. And she and I decided we needed to know a little bit more, get a little more concrete information about what this species was. We sent some of our samples off to an expert up at University of Washington, Friday Harbor, scientist up there named Charles O'Kelly. And he helped us make some really detailed images of the organism using a scanning electron microscope. And this allows us to get at very detailed features of the shape of the organism. And it turns out it has unusual features in its shape in the decorations and spines and things that are on the surface of the scales that it has on the outside. And they're just different enough that he, as an expert in dinoflagellates, believes it's what we call a hidden or cryptic species. It's one that we haven't really seen before, probably. And yeah, it probably produces yesotoxin. It's quite likely that it does. And it might be that the yesotoxin is a causative agent of some negative effect on these animals, but it's still a mystery. We're still not entirely clear. It may well be that this species that is new, that is not the same as other species of Goniolax spinifera that we've seen, and I'm pretty much putting money on the fact now that it's a new species. We haven't confirmed that yet, but morphologically, it looks like a new species, new to science. Maybe it produces a toxin we didn't test for. That could be. So these are some of the questions that kind of still remain. We're pretty sure all the sort of trails of evidence lead to this unusual species or morpho species, if you will, that we see in the water. And we're following up now with additional investigations. We're trying to get funding to pull the DNA out of some of the preserved samples that we have in our lab. If we can look at the DNA, we might be able to tell if it's a different species than the one that has been seen before. Once we know if it's a different species, that helps us because then we have something sort of, we can say, yeah, okay, it's really different. So it might produce something we're not aware of. the next step will be to take advantage of a little bit of serendipity, a little bit of messy house cleaning, if you will. When we collected the water samples, some of them we kept alive, and we just put them in the fridge. We didn't preserve them or fix them in any way. And as you might realize, you know, you have students around in the lab, they don't always clean out the fridge or clean up their stuff. Well, it turns out that dinoflagellates form resting dormant cysts when they get into conditions that they don't like. And those usually live on the bottom of the ocean, on the ocean floor. And they'll get stirred up with currents or with certain seasonal conditions, and then they'll germinate again. Well, it turns out these bottles that are in the fridge looks like they have cysts at the bottom of them. And we are going to attempt with my colleague up at Friday Harbor Labs to culture those cysts and see if we can understand more about the species. It's a bit of a long shot. Not sure if it'll work. Could take a year or more to get them to actually germinate. But if we can get them in culture, we can do a whole battery of tests to look for potentially novel toxins. So that's kind of where things are at. I think a lot of people have been really concerned about the closure of the abalone, the recreational abalone fishery. We have a lot of residents on the coast and a lot of coastal communities that depend economically a lot on some of the income that comes from the tourism, if you will, that's associated with people coming to go abalone diving. So it's a big concern. We've also spent a lot of time, trying to conserve our marine resources, and abalone is one of them. We certainly want to be cautious, I think, in what we do to protect that resource. And the kind of mortality that we saw on the coast, my colleague Laura Rogers-Bennett, who does surveys of abalone regularly, happened to have gone out and done surveys at several of the affected sites before the die-off. She went back and surveyed those sites again after the die-off. And as it turns out, there is, variable mortality in different places, but on average, about 30% of the abalone that she bumped into along her transects, her surveys, were dead. That doesn't count the ones that had already washed up. It's a fairly conservative estimate. And that's a pretty significant hit. That's a pretty significant hit in terms of mortality of the population. So the Fish and Game Commission received those data and decided it was prudent and appropriate to close the recreational fishery early and take a wait and see, and let's look and see what's happening before letting people go back. And I think that's, in the long-term interests of the population and coastal communities, probably a good thing. But we'll have to see. We'll have to see what comes.
That's quite a problem you've just given us there. I know it's this work is important just for itself, and it's also important for the abalone and the urchins, sea urchins, etc. But are there any other bigger concerns or implications that might worry you about something like this?
Well, yeah. To my knowledge, and I've seen harmful algal blooms before, as they're often called, or red tides. I've never seen this particular group of organisms affected. I've never seen a harmful algal bloom like this one, if indeed that's the causative agent. That is worrisome. What's also worrisome is that those dinoflagellates were incredibly abundant, and they formed a whole bunch of cysts that are now lying on the bottom of the ocean. And, what caused that dinoflagellate to show up all of a sudden? What caused it to do potentially so much harm? Will it come back again? That worries me. It's not a definite, but it's certainly within the realm of possibility. Were the circumstances so unusual this year that they were just right for that species and it's shown up this year and we'll never see it again, or we won't see it again for another 50 years? That could be true also. Is it something that's been around forever, that's native, that's indigenous, if you will, to the region? Could be. We don't look that much. There's not a lot of study of phytoplankton around here. So those are certainly question marks. Harmful algal species that come around that cause blooms. Sometimes a lot of scientists have hypothesized that it's in part because they get moved around the world, and sometimes they think it might be an introduced species. I have no idea if that's the case here. I'm not making a case for that, no evidence for that per se. But those cysts that are dormant, that we ended up with in our fridge that may or may not be viable, they get sucked into the ballast water of ships, ocean-going vessels that go from port to port and around the world. And then they release them in new places. So those are sort of question marks. They're questions of interest, but not, you know, don't have a strong concern about it at this point. But we wonder about those things.
So a problem. And just one of many. I wanted to ask you to turn to some more general issues now, if that's all right. You know, I think we are increasingly aware of problems in the seas. We know something about rising temperatures, dead zones, the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, endangered species, the bluefin tuna, the northern white right whale, coral, salmon. We know a little bit about that, but how should really all this concern us in a bigger picture? What are the oceans and why are they important to us? And you know, is how important is it that there seem to be these problems developing?
Well, you know, you remember when we used to worry about logging? I'm not saying we don't worry about it anymore, but deforestation and that sort of thing. And I remember I took a trip once up to Vancouver Island back in the 80s, and they had this habit of leaving a screen of trees along the roads and clear cuts behind them. And the idea was, well, people won't see them. The ocean is kind of like that to a lot of people. I'm not saying to everybody, and I'm not saying to coastal residents who are more intimate with the ocean and get into it, but people who come and interact with the ocean, you know, you see this waves, you see the blue out there, it's beautiful, it looks fine, but it's not until sometimes you get in and under and count things and look for things that you start noticing that things are missing. So I think for a lot of people, it's not clear that there's something going on. We certainly hear about salmon. That's fairly obvious. We hear about the coral reefs and those kinds of things, but there's probably a lot more going on than some of those big charismatic species, if you will. There's also a lot of physical aspects of the ocean that are important. I mean, for goodness sake, it covers 70% of the planet. It houses like over 90% of the water on the planet, right? It's modulates our climate. It moves heat around. It's involved in the water cycle. It has been an enormous buffer, if you will, for all the carbon dioxide we've been putting into the atmosphere through the burning of fossil fuels. It serves a lot of functions even aside from the biological organisms that are in there that help make this planet the planet that we know and enjoy living on. So yeah, I think there's things about the ocean and the physics of oceans and how it interacts with climate that are really important. How those affect the organisms that live in the ocean are really important. And then the ways in which we use the natural resources of the ocean. They, in the same way that the oceans are not infinite, and we're starting to see sort of the footprint, if you will, of some of our runoff in polluted estuaries and other places, you know, the ocean doesn't dilute everything forever. In the same way, the resources are not infinitely available. You can't fish every single fish in the sea and expect, you know, the population to rebound easily. You can't necessarily even fish 80% of the fish of a given population and expect it to rebound right away, even though you might still see fish there. So I think some of that, you know, those things are of concern.
This is KZYX. I'm Cal Winslow. Our program is about community and ecology. Today we're talking to Dr. Karina Nielsen. Dr. Nielsen is a marine biologist at Sonoma State University, and she spends a lot of time out here on our coast, and we're talking about some of the problems that we have in the sea today. I'll continue this discussion by asking you to tell us a little bit about the work of a marine biologist, and, you know, both as a teacher, scholar, and as a field researcher. And maybe just to introduce that, you could tell us how you got interested in this subject, and, you know, what keeps you going in this line of work.
Okay. It's I think I'll start with what the heck is a marine ecologist, and someone who's a university scientist and instructor, professor, if you will. You know, sort of what do we do? I have the honor and privilege of working at Sonoma State, and it's part of the California State University system. And one of its distinguishing features is that it really balances, sort of, if you will, the importance of instruction and teaching and research and scholarship. So my days are spent sometimes intensively teaching. The last 2 days, I've been teaching my marine invertebrate class and my marine botany class, and I've spent large portions of the day interacting with students and teaching them about the different species that comprise those big groups of organisms. It involves telling them about basically the history of evolution of animal life and plant life on the planet. Most of that, those organisms evolved from the ocean. So I spent a lot of time with sort of big topics like that. And another portion of my time, obviously I'm involved in scientific investigations and research into both applied and basic kind of topics. And scientists use those terms to mean things that are sort of relevant to everyday life versus stuff that's just interesting, that we're just curious about. How does this animal work? Why does it live where it lives? How does the fluctuation in climates and seasonality affect its growth? You know, those kinds of things. And then another piece of what we do that is also really critical to the life of sort of a university scientist is we engage in public outreach and community service. That's one of the factors that we get evaluated on in terms of our job performance. So we do have both a mission and I would say an obligation to talk broadly with members of the community about what we know, what we don't know.
So there's no pure science then allowed.
Well, no, there is pure science. Yeah. Well, that's what I mean about basic, I guess, yeah. Is what I was saying. You know, the stuff that's just, we're just curious. How does this animal work? Where did it come from? What's its evolutionary history?
But you have to do more.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, when I was a postdoc, when I was a grad student, when I was training to be a scientist, I got to focus on just sort of that pure side of it, if you will, and how, what is the process of science? You know, how do I line up evidence to sort of refute or support an idea, a theory, a hypothesis that I might have about how something works? How do I present that to colleagues? How do I write it up and publish it in a technical journal? And then,
and do you have a specialization that you would share with us?
Yeah. So, you know, you read off some big fancy words that I think describe a lot of my studies, but I'm not sure they made a whole lot of sense right on the face of it. So, when I was a graduate student, the thing I was most interested in was I call it community ecology. So, what is it that creates the patterns in nature that we see? Why are some communities completely dominated sort of more by plants than by animals? How do things like the supply of nutrients affect the number of trophic levels, the number of, I just said a big word, trophic levels. So these are, what we're talking about are like plants, herbivores, carnivores. Okay, those are trophic levels. So in the ocean, one of the features of ocean ecosystems that's so interesting is that they tend to have a greater number of trophic levels than we see on land. So you're familiar with your, you know, your grass, your cow, and let's say your wolf, right? So that would be a 3 trophic level system. In the ocean, you have things like phytoplankton or seaweeds, and then you have the things that eat those. Those could be zooplankton. They could be things like abalone that eat seaweeds. And then you have predators on top of that, sea stars, fish, larger fish, even larger fish, sharks, you know, the food chains are much longer. So one of the questions I was interested in is why is it that in some places you see systems that are dominated by the bottom of the food chain, mostly seaweeds, for example, tide pools in particular. That's what I studied for my dissertation. Why are some tide pools completely full of seaweeds, and why are some other tide pools full of sea stars or urchins? What is it that drives those differences in those patterns? And so I did a fairly extensive field experiment where I literally went and made tide pools. So they're all the same size and shape. I thought that perhaps the amount of nutrients being supplied to the pools might have had an influence on how many trophic levels you get in the system. And that is a something that just kind of intuitively makes sense. You put in more energy, you have more ability to support more organisms and perhaps higher predators in the system. And it also was a subject of some interest, in part because it's fairly challenging to study in an experimental way in the ocean, because you can't just go dumping nutrients into the ocean. It's an open system. Things are going to diffuse away. It's a little hard to replicate it and do it repeatedly over time. So in the in these little tide pool systems, I was able to rig them up so that I could dispense a little bit of nutrients when the tide would go out. And I set them up with different levels of nutrient dispensing devices. And then I could also manipulate whether the top predator or herbivore in the system was getting in or out. And I did all combinations of these. And then I looked to see if it affected the number of species that I had in the system, whether those systems were more dominated by an increasing number of herbivores or decreasing number of herbivores. So look for patterns like that. And as it turns out, those tide pools were just incredibly diverse and were incredibly informative. And I was able to show basically that the supply of nutrients that you put into the system really does impact the diversity of seaweeds that you get in the system. And at the same time, the herbivores, the number of herbivores and whether you let them in or not, completely changes the appearance of those pools. And both of those things work together to create some of the patterns that we see in nature. So what does it tell us about anything that we might care about in a very sort of concrete sort of way? So it's kind of like theoretical. Some of it's kind of like, well, yeah, of course, you fertilize your garden, you're going to get more stuff in it. But there's some subtleties to it. When we put a lot of fertilizer into a garden, you might get sort of growth of one species only. You might not get a very diverse system. So there were questions like that that I was trying to get at and tease apart so that we could understand better what are the implications of, say, runoff from agriculture into coastal ecosystems. What's it going to do? How is that going to interact with the fact that we may have reduced the populations of top consumers, predators, carnivores, herbivores, because we fish them to eat them? So even though it was a very pure sort of basic question about the structure of these communities, it has some clues or some insights to more applied problems. So those were the realm of stuff that I like to work on.
Okay. I also wanted to ask you about, something which would be more of your community work. And that is, I understand that you've been involved in the discussion of marine reserves. And I wondered if you could say just a little bit about what you think about marine reserves, wherever.
Okay.
And then about, you know, your own involvement.
Well, first of all, marine reserves are one kind of marine protected area. So I'll use the term marine protected area as a sort of an overarching term. Marine reserves, scientists think of those as areas where you don't take anything out of the system. So it's like a nature preserve where there's no hunting and there's no logging and no destructive activities. You don't go in there and mine. You don't do anything like that. So a marine reserve has no extractive activities in it. Within this sort of bigger picture of marine protected areas, you can also have areas that are managed for conservation of a particular species or have an objective like the marine sanctuaries, which are largely there for no disturbance to the seafloor, things like that. So there are a variety of different protections that areas can have. I would say that over the past 20 years or so, our understanding of what happens in places of the coast or of the ocean that you put into reserves, these no extractive activities areas, has really increased. And part of that has come from little small studies that have been done in areas, say near a marine lab, where they decide, you know what, we're just going to take this area and we're just going to say no fishing, no nothing, because we're trying to figure out how nature works and we just want to see what's going on here. And I had the privilege when I was a postdoctoral researcher, so it was right after I finished my PhD, I was funded through the National Science Foundation to go work down in Chile. You mentioned earlier that I worked down there, and I spent about 2 years living down in Chile. And I was stationed at a marine lab in Las Cruces in Chile, and it was a small little marine lab that happened to have one of the very first fully protected marine reserves around. And there was a very visionary scientist there named Juan Carlos Castilla, who was just really, really curious what would the intertidal zone and the subtidal zone in front of this marine station look like if it wasn't inundated with people collecting animals and plants from the shore. Now, if you were to go to Chile and go to the coast, people there love the coast. Sometimes they love it to death. they spend a lot of time at the coast in the summer. They eat a lot of seafood. They have terrific seafood. And people out there will take almost anything from the shore and eat it. They'll eat these giant kelps. They'll eat these things that are kind of like our abalone. They're called loco. They're actually a carnivore. They're not a herbivore. And they're not crazy. The name loco comes from the indigenous name, the Mapuche name for the organism. So, but they are very analogous to our abalone, that they're tasty, they're easy to pick up. And people were harvesting a lot of these. They were harvesting a lot of these keyhole limpets, which are these big, flat, sort of plate-like mollusks with a hole at the top. They look like a little volcano. And he was just watching them and going, God, there's an awful lot of people taking an awful lot of stuff. What would happen if they weren't there, if those people weren't there? What would the shoreline look like? And he was able to get in Chile, the way the ocean governance works is you can apply to the government for a lease. And you can lease an area. And so he got a lease for the university for this, you know, not very big stretch of shoreline, maybe a kilometer in length at most, I think. I don't even think it was that much. I take that back. Smaller, quarter kilometer in length. And, you know, maybe several hundred meters off the coast. And he said, okay, that's mine. I get to manage it now, and I'll keep people out. So that put up quite a... They were quite upset, actually, when he did that, the local people, because that was one of their favorite places to collect. And they were a little frustrated by it. But one of the things that they noticed over time was that, oh my goodness, after 5-10 years, that you could see a line. You didn't even need a fence. You could see the difference between inside and outside because the structure of the community, the plants and animals that you saw inside the reserve, were completely different from what was outside. There were a lot larger animals. There were many more of them. And over the years, they started looking at the evidence of, well, what are the effects of having this sort of big savings account, if you will, of natural capital in this spot that's so different? Well, as it turned out, where do you think everybody went to fish and collect in that town after, you know, sort of rebounded inside there? Well, they all went right to the edge of the reserve, because it turns out that a lot of these big creatures, you know, after they grow up happy, healthy, fat, they don't have enough room to live inside the reserve. And so they start crawling and swimming out. And it turned out that, you know, the best catches were at the edges because of this phenomenon that we call spillover. The other thing that started happening that they started to notice was that there seemed to be some evidence that, in fact, the populations of a lot of the seaweeds that they were collecting that rebounded within the reserve started to actually increase outside the reserve as well. And the evidence for that accumulated over many years, but it looked like basically the capital that they put into that reserve was producing interest, if you will. I mean, I know I'm using a really like crass economic analogy here, but you know, there were spores and larvae of many of these organisms. The marine animals were spawning and spilling over and settling outside the borders of the reserve and growing up, and they were replenishing some of those stocks or populations that were a little depleted on the outside as well. So there's a whole bunch of evidence that started, and this is not, you know, this is one place, one location, right? Chile. But it wasn't the only place that these marine reserves were sort of tested out in small scale. And the evidence has accumulated over numerous years now of this phenomenon. You tend to get an increase in biomass of animals inside of reserves. Diversity has a tendency to increase. The average size of the animals increases. And these have important consequences, not just within the boundaries of the reserves, but outside. And what's so important, really, and you know, this it should be obvious in some ways, that a bigger, fatter, more fecund animal is going to produce more babies. Okay, but for a lot of marine organisms, it's not just proportional to how big they are. It's exponentially proportional to how big they are. So an animal that is twice as big may produce 10 or 100 times as many offspring as one that's half its size, okay? You get what I'm saying here.
Yeah,
so,
sure.
So for just a little bit of increase in size of animals, you get a big payoff in terms of the reproductive output of those animals. And what scientists started to study and started to think about was like, wow, you know, maybe if we had kind of stepping stones or networks of these things, they would create this effect of connectivity among the reserves and really help sustain some of the populations that are being exploited outside of the reserves. And we started to develop this big set of studies and theoretical studies and modeling, and then more reserves were set up, and we started to get this increased understanding that there might be this really sort of added value to having more than just one spot in the coastline and reserve. And it might help create a bit of an insurance policy for sort of unexpected events. And that's sort of the history of the development of the ideas behind marine reserves. So how does this connect to community work? Well, California passed an act, the Marine Life Protection Act, back in, I guess it was 99, and started to implement development and of marine protected areas, and a network in particular was what the law, the act stated they wanted. So when I moved down to Sonoma County in 2003, I started to get involved with various colleagues in the area, and eventually at some point I got asked if I would participate on a science advisory team for planning of marine protected areas in the North Central Coast of California. And that was a region bounded basically by Point Arenas down to Pigeon Point. And then ultimately I served on a science advisory team as well for the North Coast. And I was one of many, many scientists involved with different expertise, oceanography, fisheries biology. There were social scientists involved. And we gave guidelines and advice about what do we know about how these reserves could work? What might be the most beneficial sort of parameters about how to design a network? And we worked together with groups of stakeholders to help them help them figure out where would be good places to put these things. How could we meet sort of conservation goals and not have really undue painful impact on the coastal communities and the fisheries in the region? And the idea was that it didn't so much matter exactly where you put them, but that you know, there should be a certain amount of habitat to represent the habitat for each of the species that you might want to conserve, and that they should be spaced not too far apart so that you could have connectivity between them. And we really worked with the stakeholders to provide guidelines and help them figure out where to put them to be effective. And that was a quite involved process. A lot of colleagues put in an awful lot of hours gathering as much of the most current data and information that they could, both about the region specifically and about the ocean conditions specifically, locally, how those might interact with the placement of different marine protected areas and marine reserves, and what the costs and benefits might be of a particular proposal that the stakeholders put forward. Hours and hours and hours of time. And I think at the end of the day, the state of California has gotten a pretty good plan out of all of the hours of public commentary, the stakeholders from the public who put effort into designing these things, the scientists who contributed their knowledge, and the politicians who ended up trying to figure out what to do when there were things that didn't work well in terms of you had different proposals and it was hard to come to agreement for some groups on certain specifics of different areas. And in terms of process, I know a lot of people like to say, oh, the MLPA, I got processed. it was, you know, they talk a lot about process. But I guess at the end of the day, I think there was an awful lot of input, an awful lot of thought, an awful lot of attempting to do something that would work well, both from the perspective of local communities and long-term potential benefits. So now we have, if you will, in some ways, a big experiment that's unfolding, and we need to see if it's working.
And there any results yet, do you think?
I think there are some early results from some of the regions that started at the beginning, but we're ramping up to sort of have the whole state in this series of networks. And I think the early results are consistent with what we thought the benefits would be from these smaller reserves and some of the theoretical work. But we got to give it a little more time to play out. 5 years, not a very long time to see these responses. The reserve that I talked about in Chile that I had the pleasure of hanging out around 20 years after its implementation or so, It took a while to see the results. So we're starting to see early hints that they're working in the ways that we expected. We're learning a little bit more about the ecology of the region as part of those results. There has been a significant investment in having scientists go out and monitor these things to get sort of what are the baseline conditions in them and set the stage for coming back in 5 years and looking again and going, okay, what changed, what didn't? So we're not just looking inside the reserves and the protected areas and the conservation areas. We're looking outside as well, so that if things are changing in both places at the same time in the same way, we'll know about it. We'll know whether those changes are attributable to the management, the closures, if you will, or the restrictions on what you can do in those places, or whether it's just environmental variation. And I think as those answers start coming in, we'll have a better sense of whether these are valuable, whether they're achieving the results we hope they might, and we'll have an opportunity to assess whether to tweak them a little bit, but it'll take a little time to get that evidence.
And this is going on internationally?
It's going on in...
You've been talking about California, beyond that, this is a global movement?
There are a lot of marine protected areas going in a lot of different places around the world. It's not just California. Although I would say that the state of California is probably leading the most comprehensive planning process for such a large scale and such a large network.
This is KZYX. I'm Cal Winslow. This is Community and Ecology. Today we're talking to Dr. Karina Nielsen. She's a professor of marine biology at Sonoma State University. So we have some time left. I also understand that you've been involved in and a possible marine science center here in Mendocino County, possibly in the Fort Bragg area. Is that right? And could you would you mind just telling us what people have in mind, what people are looking for?
Well, I came on the scene really after the initial planning and idea development for this. As many of you know, the former Georgia Pacific mill site in Fort Bragg is slated for redevelopment, and the city of Fort Bragg has been very engaged in thinking through how to zone the different areas of the mill site and what the acceptable uses might be, and they sought a lot of community input. And my understanding is that as part of that process of receiving community input, one of the top desires or wishes of the community was to see some kind of a science education, marine science education type facility there that might help work with understanding more about the marine environment and how to rejuvenate fisheries and
would it be really like the Bodega Bay facility?
Well, I think a lot of people had in mind the Bodega Bay Marine Lab as a sort of, oh, we would love to have something like that here. And that, you know, I think actually what the community up here wants is something a little different from a Bodega Bay Marine Lab. Bodega Bay Marine Lab is, Bodega Marine Lab, is a very research-intensive facility. It's also an educational facility for university students and graduate students, and they certainly engage in some public outreach. But I think what the community up here is looking for is something a little more interactive, a little more community engaged. They've been working with staff at the Coastal Conservancy, and they were looking to perhaps create an advisory board or a group, a consortium, if you will, of research interested parties to develop the center, the concept for the center, raise funding for the center, design it, sort of what it would be. And at a certain point, a funding opportunity came up through the state of California for nature education centers. And at that point, I had been involved with a lot of research in the area and had been sort of following the progress of the development of this idea through the city council meetings and things that were going on where they were sort of developing a conceptual plan for this place. And I got involved because I said, oh, you know, it's going to be up here. I do research up here. This sounds like a great project to bring scientific and educational resources into the community and build a real, really interesting center that would be pretty interdisciplinary, that wouldn't be just a highbrow sort of pure research kind of place, if you will. And I managed to convince folks at Sonoma State in the administration and our director of field stations and nature preserves, Claudia Luke, to take a look and see if we could help out. And we consulted with the city and helped them write a proposal for this big grant opportunity. Unfortunately, we were not successful in winning that award, but in the process of going after the award, we were able to design a facility, get architectural plans, have a conceptual plan, get the faculty at Sonoma State interested in the idea and excited about the idea. And even though we, so the idea has come along quite a ways. Right now it's sort of conceptually organized around an education center and a research center, so that it would really engage the community in a number of ways.
Could you think you could imagine what it might look like if I, say, decided I wanted to go up there with my children some afternoon and walk in the door? What would I find?
What we were envisioning was an interpretive center that would interpret the linkages between sort of river, forests, and ocean, sort of the coastal margin, if you will. How do people and the processes that happen at the edge of the coastline interact with the ocean? And we were imagining an exhibit space, for example, that has information on redwood forests and on the kelp forests off the shore, and a little, you know, a tide pool that you could go and touch and look at organisms in, and perhaps even the that big blue whale skeleton that is composting away somewhere that hopefully will get reassembled one day in the city of Fort Bragg for people to enjoy and learn more about whales and those sorts of things. So, and then on the side, adjacent to it, would be some research facilities so that you could have scientists actually come and work with, do, say, for example, collaborative fisheries research and work with local fishermen and try and figure out more about how to do the best we can by...
In partnership with Sonoma State or something?
Well, the idea was that, you know, these kinds of institutions do best when they have some sort of academic partnership. It gives them some sort of credibility. And Sonoma State is sort of certainly interested, has been interested in collaborating. Obviously, these are tough financial times. This is not something that we're going to open up. There's not a wallet full of money to do this. So we're still working with the city to try and strategize about how we can advance this project. I'd say that's sort of where we're at right now. It's gotten pretty far along, but...
And would it be a place that might inspire future professors like yourself?
Sure. I would hope so. Although I have to say, you know, my inspiration it should. I would hope so.
We've been talking to Professor Karina Nielsen of Sonoma State, and we'll end there today. Thank you very much, Karina. It's been very interesting, and I'd like to thank all of you who have been listening today as well. This is KZYX, and I'm Cal Winslow, and I'd like to invite you to listen next week when we're going to be talking about work and the people who do it. Thanks very much. Goodbye.